This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news. This afternoon, we'll hear how the local community is reacting to the judge declaring a mistrial in the case of former UC police officer Ray Tenzing and the shooting death of Sam DeBose, and a look at the new political landscapes in both Ohio and Kentucky after last week's election. You can join the conversation this afternoon at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us first to talk about local reaction to the mistrial declared in the Ray Tenzing case, race and communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Canute, and WVXU reporter and digital editor Tana Weingartner. And Mark and Tana, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's good to be here.
Mark, you were on the courthouse steps outside when the decision of a mistrial came down. What kind of reaction did you observe when that happened?
A multitude. Just as there's no monolithic attitude in the black community or perspective, it's a mix. Mix between anger, sadness. I mean, some people wept. Some people got very vocal and angry, and I think the thing that impressed me most was how the leadership of the Black Lives Matter Cincinnati organization really kept people, again, while not muting opinion, really kept things organized and really had a very focused, disciplined event the rest of that day. But again, Mark, it was just one of again, anger, sadness, disbelief, because the sense that people had late Thursday and into Friday and even Friday evening was the likelihood of a conviction for voluntary manslaughter. So when that didn't come to fruition, the longer things dragged on and the increasing number of times the jury came back to ask a question, the more of a sense came out there that there was going to be a hung jury.
And in your observations, were you surprised that this ended in a deadlock like it did?
No.
Yeah. Tana, what were your observations on the reactions of people when that decision came down?
I would say it was a lot like what Mark just described. I mean, we were looking I showed up a little bit later after that, but the same sort of concerns. And an interesting balance between people calling for peace and other people within the same movement calling for no peace, not necessarily violence. I don't want to say that, but, a militant action, I think was the word they kept using. You can't just keep sitting by and saying, be peaceful. So it was kind of a dual reaction in that term.
I think it's something I've learned as I've spent a lot of time covering this, the build up to the trial and then during the trial being in the community and outside of the courthouse, is that the definition of words like peace and violence and unrest, Black Lives Matter made it really clear that peace is the absence of justice or injustice. Peace is the lack of justice. Or the presence of justice. I'm sorry, I'm mixed up here.
So peace is the presence of justice.
Okay. Right. But so in their perspective, when the hung jury was declared, the march itself, even though there was only one arrest for a broken car window down on Fifth Street, from what I understand from the police, the fact that the march took off and they just took off into the streets, really almost against the objections of the police department, that was a non-peaceful reaction to their claim, their perception of the injustice of the hung jury.
How much, Mark, has this case set off a broader discussion of race issues in Cincinnati?
I think since the shooting, last July of 2015 of Sam DeBose, I think it's percolated. I was employed at the Urban League at the time as a vice president. And a month later, the Urban League, under the direction of Donna Jones Baker, released the State of Black Cincinnati report, which, again, while it didn't break a lot of news, put everything, the racial disparities of health, criminal justice, et cetera, into one place. And I think that propelled the discussion. But I think the buildup, and I think the other thing too, Mark and Tana, that I've seen is is these police community issues or shootings of unarmed men. You know, we just saw the charges come down in the Philando Castile case in St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, those with social media, those feel local in the community. Those aren't 500, 600, 700 miles away anymore. Those are local. And even though people know it's the CPD or other jurisdictions, and in this case, the Tenzing case, you know, you see police, it's an accumulative effect of frustration. You know, I think really starting with Ferguson that has brought, you know, in the Michael Brown shooting in 2014, has really brought this issue in a contemporary kind of post-racial quote marks around that sense back to the forefront.
Tana, we've since learned that the jury took an informal vote at the beginning of deliberations. It wasn't a binding vote, apparently, but what exactly happened with that?
Well, you know, we keep getting different information or new additional information, it seems, every time. So, you know, another talk show happens. But the latest that we've heard was there was apparently a straw poll vote at some point at the beginning of their negotiations that would have been 12-0. And so we're not really sure what went from there, how it became ended in this hung jury.
And it was 12-0 that it was a purposeful murder is what I believe it was.
That's
right?
What we understand.
That was what was reported the other day in the Inquirer.
Right. Yeah. And then I believe is what we were told as well by the prosecutor's office. But then with the final vote being the 8-4, 4 being not guilty, which I just want to correct. That was something that I misstated the last time I was on this program. So
that's all clear. Yeah.
We had some incorrect information that was since clarified to us by the prosecutor's office.
So I guess – and then what happened is once after they took that straw poll, they just kept deliberating and deliberating until we eventually got to the point where it was a deadlocked jury. So –
right. What I've got, what my colleagues at the Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge and Kevin Grasha, reported, you know, the 12 juries who heard the case against Ray Tenzing took a straw poll at the start of deliberations and said they would convict him of murder. So clearly, as you said, somewhere in those 25-plus hours of deliberations, it ended hung.
Mark, is there pretty much a consensus from the people you've talked to that this should be retried?
Oh, without question. Spoke with Pastor Ennis Tate from Church of the Living God in Avondale on Sunday. You know, he tipped me off that the a new coalition, a multi-cross-denominational coalition of black ministers that have several thousands of congregants throughout the region in the city were coming together. And as it came to fruition, held the press conference at noon on Monday outside the prosecutor's office on 9th Street, where they demanded a retrial and gave a deadline per se, but wanted an answer back from Joe Dieters, the prosecutor, by this coming Monday, the 21st. The short answer is I do believe there is a great deal of outcry in the black community. And I just came by 9th Street, the prosecutor's office, about 15, 20 minutes ago. And there were probably a dozen Black Lives Matter protesters out there as well. So they've maintained a vigil over the noon hour every day since the mistrial was declared.
Have any other faith organizations joined these black ministers in calling for a retrial?
Oh, without question. You've got the Amos Project under the leadership of Troy Jackson, which is more Catholic-based. It's a coalition of about 50 different faith communities. You have the Muslim communities with the imam Charter from the Islamic Center. I'm really off today. I apologize. But from the mosque in Clifton, right. The Clifton Mosque. Mm-hmm. So there have been, there's concerns, I think, across the board. But you know, it's primarily Christian denominations, multiple denominations out of the Christian church.
Either of you think city council making a call for a retrial, was that unusual in any way?
Well, I don't know that it's unusual. I think that they wanted to show their support for what they think should happen. Of course, it's not a binding agreement or anything like that. It's just a resolution showing their support. They do that frequently on lots of different things.
Right. And I think the other piece that we reported, and I think it came out of some of our video that we shot with some of our media partners last Saturday during the march, and it was over when the police and council member Yvette Simpson prevented or spoke to the leaders of the march and prevented them from going further farther west on 9th Street, which would have led them to the interstate, to 75, and they were redirected north on Central Avenue, you know, wound around and ended up in Washington Park. There were the chief was there and was very sympathetic, Chief Isaac, toward the marchers and was not supportive of the actions of Ray Tenzing and Scotty Johnson, who is a specialist who is is in the administration of the police department, you know, basically said twice, and we got it on video where he said this guy should be in the penitentiary.
But so far, all the protests that we've had, they've all been relatively peaceful, relatively calm, and nothing really major happening in any of them.
Right. I think we reported, my colleague Cameron Knight, whom I worked with on the story on Saturday, got one arrest. And I followed that up with CPD, and it was for a broken car window down there as Fountain Square, as the march wound past Fountain Square. Largely peaceful and
right. And that was a joint march at that point. I feel like we should
we should clarify that.
It's not just the Black Lives Matter march that was happening. It coincided with an anti-Trump demonstration that was moving throughout the city.
So you ended up with, a couple thousand people, was it?
I think the estimate that I saw was around 1,000.
The police estimated 1,000, but they, again, I'll just be honest, I think they're historically low. And it was pretty remarkable. I think you were over there as well, Tana, mm-hmm. as we took off west, the demonstrators took off west on Court Street, met at Walnut and Court with a column of anti-Trump demonstrators who were primarily white, coming south on Walnut, and when the anti-Trump people saw the Black Lives Matter people, they changed their chant to Black Lives Matter. So there was a merger right there at Walnut and Court, and the march proceeded south there on Walnut.
This really was a convergence then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a well-timed one.
A well-timed one.
it wasn't by coincidence. Yes.
Okay. Big question now, of course, as we mentioned, is there going to be another trial? So I guess that's up to Joe Dieters at this point as to whether this gets retried.
Right. That's our understanding. That's what he said he'll say by the 28th, as Mark was saying, that Faith Leaders Group have asked for something sooner. You know, everything Joe has said, Dieters has said, you know, this is a decision he'll make, you know, not overly influenced by outside.
So he's saying this, he's going to make this independently then.
Right. He has told my colleague Sharon Coolidge, had an interview with him. I'm sorry to keep name dropping, but I think the media did a good job, and I'm especially, congratulatory of my colleagues that worked inside the courthouse under some difficult circumstances. But, Sherry had the interview with Joe on Monday morning as the protest outside was starting to form. And Joe said, you know, this became very personal to him because he got to know the DuBose family very well. And there's photos.
He's strongly convinced this was a case
and he,
of murder.
And he maintains that. And I think his bottom line is, can he win? If he decides to retry him, it's can he win it? He didn't win it this time. But there seems to be enough. The other piece that was reported that the jury came back at 8-4. To convict for voluntary manslaughter. So there was a sense, along with the straw poll, that there were people that felt that Ray Tenzing, was guilty of one of those two charges.
Which would certainly lean toward thinking that there would certainly be another trial of some kind on some charges.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the murder manslaughter.
Right, I'm not
charge.
A legal scholar, so I'm not sure how the process would need to play out if the charges were to be changed to something else, but they could.
And again, Dieters is saying he's weighing whether he thinks he could win it the next time around, whether it would make sense to retry it, or whether he thinks they might just end up deadlocked, or maybe even a not guilty verdict coming back.
Right, and exactly, and the other piece that came out of his, I believe this was, Tano, were you in the courthouse when the hung jury was declared?
No, I wasn't inside.
But there was a media scrum around Joe Dieters after the mistrial was declared in the courthouse, and he did say, I think someone did ask him, what would the cost of retrying be? And he said roughly $1 million, which set off a great deal of anger. You asked earlier, Mark, about the reaction outside. And when that became known outside Saturday as the day wore on, and you can say it's not congruent potentially, but in the mind and eye of the black community here, you know, the figure $1.7 million to try Tracy Hunter, the former juvenile court judge, came right to the forefront. And, you know, whether, you know, just the idea that you spent this much money on Tracy Hunter versus you're saying it would be $1 million to retry Ray Tensing, again, was a source of anger and frustration among the demonstrators, and really escalated throughout the day and into even Monday. Bishop Bobby Hilton spoke of that at the protest or the rally outside of the prosecutor's office.
Mark, do you have a sense of where this is headed? Do you think it will be retried?
Oh,
toughie, isn't it?
It's a toughie, but if you said, you know, if you go back to the 5149 thing, like in court, I would say yes. I think given, you know, you add up the pieces, the straw poll prior to the deliberations, you add up the 8-4 revelation of the standing for manslaughter. You know, I do think, and then
it would certainly seem to be enough evidence for a prosecutor,
right? And
to
Joe
want
Dieters, and Joe
with.
Dieters stated, as you said earlier, Mark and Tana, that his conviction that it was murder.
Right.
You know, I think he believes it was. Therefore, I do think it will go ahead.
Well, Mark and Tana, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Race and Communities reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Mark Kernute, and WVXU reporter and digital editor, Tana Weingartner. Coming up, a look at the changes in Kentucky state government after last week's election. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. In the run-up to last week's election, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky had on his wish list that his home state's government would become more Republican. And that's exactly what happened on Tuesday, as the GOP now controls Kentucky's House, Senate, and the governor's office. And joining us to talk about it, Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ryland, good afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So Mitch McConnell gets his wish. How long has it been, Ryland, since the political control of the Kentucky House last changed like it did in this election?
Well, the last time the House was controlled by Republicans was 95 years ago. 1922 was the year when Democrats came into power in the House. This is the first time ever Republicans have had control of both the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, you know, those being the three bodies you need to have control of the legislative process. Republicans are pretty excited about it. They've been mounting challenges on the House for the last several years, and they're finally able to break through, and broke through in with flying colors. They now have a supermajority in both the House and the Senate, which means that they can pass constitutional amendments if they stay united. They can override the governor's vetoes. It's a pretty powerful position.
Yeah, it sounds like a major power shift. Now, Jeff Hoover is going to be the next House Speaker in Kentucky. Tell us about him.
It appears to be he'll be the next House Speaker. His caucus has unanimously voted to nominate him. The official vote will take place on the first day of the legislative session, which is January 3rd. Jeff Hoover is a he's somebody I think is widely respected within his caucus, and I think has shown a tendency to reach across the aisle when he was minority leader of the House. He's a Republican from Jamestown. He's been in the House, Jamestown being in kind of south central Kentucky on the near the Cumberland River or Lake Cumberland, and his mother was a state representative as well in the 80s. She actually served in that seat after his father was elected to that seat, died, and then there's a special election, and she won that seat.
So likely that Jeff Hoover will be the next House Speaker. How inclined is he to be inclusive? Is he somebody who's going to shut out the Democrats, or is he somebody who's saying, "Nah, I know how you guys feel. We've been in the minority, so I want both voices."
Yeah, he says he's going to include everybody. That's something that he was very loud as the leader of the minority party when Republicans were in the minority. I was very loud about feeling that the Democratic majority wasn't giving giving the minority due respect, says that there, you know, there were committees in which that were stacked with Democrats and not enough Republicans on them. That bills Republicans would push for weren't even given any consideration. He says that under his leadership, that that'll all change. He wants to change the tone of things in Frankfurt. He's definitely tried to strike this conciliatory tone in these 2 weeks since Republicans won that election. And I mean, he's struck that tone. The Senate President Robert Sivers has struck that tone as well. Governor Bevin has kind of taken hasn't struck that tone yet. He's still kind of bellicose after the election. He said good riddance to Democratic Speaker Greg Stumbo, so we'll kind of see going into the legislative session how much Republicans. Consider the minority's wishes.
Is Governor Bevin still dealing with these accusations that he's tried to force some lawmakers to switch parties?
Yeah, there's this ongoing committee. It's a House investigatory committee set forth by the Democratic Speaker Greg Stumbo. I mean, he was actually voted out of office, so his term will end on January 3rd. This committee is still going forward. They're investigating allegations that lawmakers have made that the governor bullied them into switching parties. There's another one of these meetings today. There hasn't a whole lot of hard evidence hasn't been put forward. In one case, a lawmaker is saying that the governor pulled or froze a road project in his district because he didn't switch to the Republican Party. And today there is another lawmaker who's making pretty similar allegations. The thing is this committee will very, very, very likely not exist in a matter of weeks once Republicans take over the House. And it's unclear if this will produce any findings. They say they have subpoena power, that they'll be able to get transportation cabinet officials or lawmakers who are making these allegations to compel them to testify. But there's some question as to whether they actually have subpoena power. So there just seems to be a whole bunch of noise around this, and it's unclear if it'll produce any really coherent findings.
Ryland, Governor Bevin was able to dismantle Connect. Now that he has, GOP controls both the House and the Senate. Does he have any other issues that he's looking to get his way on now that he's got more backing than he's had in the past?
Certainly, taking the way of the legislature, he really wants to pass a right to work law. That would forbid employers from requiring employees to become members of a union as a condition of employment. Pro-life legislation certainly in the sights. The one discrete thing we've gotten out of the governor and House and other leaders is they want to tackle tax reform. This is something that's been on the plate for years. And it probably won't happen in this legislative session, the governor has said he wants to get rid of the inheritance tax, or not of the estate tax, and also the inventory tax. That's the other one. There's a whole bunch of priorities that Republicans have wanted to get through, say that the Republican-led Senate has passed. And in the past, this Democratic House has been a big stumbling block for that kind of legislation. So without that in place, we could see a lot of this, a lot more conservative legislation going through.
You were talking about Greg Stumbo earlier, the current House Speaker. What is he saying about the shift in power? What's been his reaction?
We talked to him a couple days ago. That was the first time I had seen him since the election, and he didn't seem, his hair wasn't on fire or anything. He seemed to be taking it pretty well. I think that's exactly what he said. He says that his political career isn't necessarily over, but he's 65 years old, and he noted there's rising stars in the party, so he's not sure exactly what he might pursue next, aside from pursuing law practice in Eastern Kentucky. I think that you know, it's certainly something that he would have rather not see the House switch hands. But I do imagine that he, along with many other House Democrats and political observers in the state, also, you know, saw the writing on the wall. The state's has become increasingly Republican. I mean, it's been conservative for a long time, but you know, now Democrats don't appear to be, or at least the sense is that Democrats aren't carrying that conservative mantle, and so people aren't voting for them into office anymore. There's still some Democrats still getting elected here, but you know, not on as wide of a spread as we saw in the past.
Might be a little tougher in Kentucky. Rand Paul was reelected to the U.S. Senate. He beat Democratic challenger Jim Gray. Thoughts on that?
Jim Gray, I think that it was a lack of name recognition across the state. He's relatively popular mayor of Lexington, and he's had some success there. He's he's in his second term now. But he's originally from Glasgow in the, you know, kind of south central Kentucky. But you know, out in the state, I don't think he's as well known. And also, you can't really underestimate or overstate the impact of Donald Trump's very long coattails in Kentucky. I think it was just very it was hard for Democrats to get elected these days. And another thing, also, you know, Hillary Clinton being at the top of the ticket, and that line about putting a whole lot of coal companies and coal miners out of business, that is just ubiquitous in ads in Kentucky. And I think that really sandbagged Democrats like Jim Gray.
Ryland, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. Coming up, we'll talk about the new political landscape in Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me now to discuss the election's impact in Ohio, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Politics and Government reporter Paula Christian, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. So Paula, Joe, and Howard, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So let's start at the presidential level, Howard. Okay. Donald Trump wins Ohio by 8%. What do you think were the keys for him?
Well, I think it was pretty clear that if you look at the demographics, you know, there were a whole lot of people in, like, take Southeast Ohio, for example. This is a chronically economically depressed area of the state. High unemployment, always. Industries like the coal industry, which have gone belly up. If you go into Eastern Ohio, industries like steel industry, which have gone belly up. And there's a whole lot of people who feel they've been left behind, and they didn't feel like anybody, whether it was the Republican leadership in Congress or Democrats like Hillary Clinton, were listening to them or cared about them. And here comes this fellow, Donald Trump, whom they'd seen on TV, and they knew who he was, and he was a celebrity. And he was very forceful, and he said, I can fix this. I alone can fix this. And they believed it. Now, that happened, and it happened in large numbers. He won 66% of the vote in Southeast Ohio, which is pretty incredible. He won 70% in 30, over 30 of the smaller counties in Ohio. And that's how he put together this coalition to win in Ohio. But he also led, the exit polling shows that he also led, and this will actually blew my mind when I saw it, he led among white college-educated women in Ohio. He led among...
That's a surprise because
it is.
That's not something anybody really expected.
It's counterintuitive.
At least not in the media, yeah.
And he led among union households mm-hmm. in Ohio.
That doesn't actually surprise me. The union part for the I went to several unions and spoke to, asked them about who they supported. The leadership would outwardly support Hillary Clinton, but the rank and file would be very quiet. They wouldn't say anything. Then afterwards, they'd say, I support Trump, privately.
Yeah. I had the same experience at the Labor Day picnic, you know, out at Coney Island mm-hmm. when Bill Clinton was out there mm-hmm. and was talking to a lot of rank and file. And they were like, well, I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. it's, you know, well, I'll make up my mind later. But, you know, they were very open to the idea of voting for Donald Trump.
Joe, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I was, like your panelists there, I was surprised with the women's vote. I was not surprised with the union vote because we had been hearing that difference between what leadership said and what membership said. One thing, though, I noticed when I talked to women who were supporting Donald Trump, a lot of them were not really interested in issues that traditionally affect women. You never heard them come up with, you know, well, we're concerned about equal pay or we're concerned about the right to have an abortion. There were always other issues that those women who were voting for Trump were, you know, looking at when they were making that choice. And then you look at the women who supported Hillary Clinton, and that often came up. And I think, you know, the frame of reference was just different for a lot of women in this election, depending on where they are in the stage of their life or where what their point of view is in general.
Joe, the Mahoning Valley, which is traditionally a Democratic, very Democratic area, how big a role did that play?
That was a big deal because what had happened is that was an area that traditionally Democrats have done very well in. It's very union. They've had a lot of manufacturing jobs, and a lot of those jobs have left. And so, you know, that's an area where generally the Democrats expect to win it. But this time around, with Trump coming in there and talking about the trade deals that don't work for America and how he's going to fix them and how they all need to be renegotiated, that was striking a chord with a lot of the people in that area who had watched those jobs leave and maybe watched their own job leave.
But the fact, the bottom line of the matter is those jobs aren't coming back, period, anytime, no matter what Donald Trump says. I mean, they're going to be, you know, their economic salvation in places like the Mahoning Valley lies elsewhere.
We had several discussions about how difficult it would be for Trump to win Ohio without Governor John Kasich's support. Mm. And Paula's nodding her head.
Paula remembers those discussions.
So much for that.
Yeah. So much for that. Kasich's been pretty quiet. At least he seems to be pretty quiet to me
since the election. Well, what could he possibly say at this point? I mean, he did publicly say he was praying for Trump's success in the presidency. He did tweet out on the night of the election that some congratulations, but beside that, he's been quiet. I mean, really, what else could he say? If he says, oh, he'll make a great president, then he looks like a hypocrite. And if he criticizes him, I mean, he looks anti-American for criticizing his president. So what choice does he have other than to be quiet?
To be silent.
Joe, how do you think he's going to fare?
Well, let's put it this way. I haven't seen Governor Kasich be silent for very long.
That's a good point.
That's true, yeah.
Usually he finds a way to make his voice heard. And I think right now he's kind of decided, hey, I'm just going to, you know, chill. I'm going to let this all, you know, I'm not going to be out here, you know, throwing stones right now. I'm going to let it all pan out, let him pick his cabinet, let him get in there, and then start looking at the direction it's headed. Now, if you looked during the presidential primary, Governor Kasich really liked to be in that middle. He wanted to play the role of the moderate, the adult in the room, that sort of thing. And it played pretty well here in Ohio, and I think it played nationally, it played very well in some spaces. You just had Trump out there who was kind of taking, you know, the wind out of the sails. But if Trump goes in office and if the Republicans have a lot of infighting, which that's a very possible thing because you look at what they say they want and they're not all on the same page there, And so when that starts happening, that gives Governor Kasich the opportunity to go in there and make his point known on a lot of these key issues, and he would look like more of the moderate. So I think, you know, right now he's probably just sitting back and waiting.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, it would be. I'd be curious to see post-election what his approval ratings are. Mm-hmm. My guess is it really hasn't changed very much. He's still, you know, pretty popular with Ohio voters. Whether or not he has any, I mean, obviously he can't run for re-election as governor. But 2018, there's a U.S. Senate seat that's up.
Well, see, now that's where some experts I talked to said this whole thing could come back to bite him if he does run for Senate in 2018. And all of a sudden, Republicans who do support Trump are reminding everybody of all the nasty things that he said about about the president. And Trump has a lot of support in Ohio, obviously, and, you know, that's going to come into play.
And one of the things that we're going to have to wait and see, and it's way too early to tell, is that support for Trump going to be durable?
Yes.
I think that there were a whole lot of Republican voters or Republican-leaning voters who really didn't have a very favorable view of Donald Trump. You know, they weren't in love with him, but they ended up voting for him. And if he does not deliver on his promises, or if he is perceived as a failure as president, those people will be gone. They will no longer be willing to support him.
And one thing I'd like to remind everyone is that 2 years is a very, very long time.
Oh, yes.
And, you know,
especially
I remember.
In politics. Yes.
Right. In politics, that's an eternity. I remember when Governor Kasich, the whole Senate Bill 5 thing went down, and we were all looking at the numbers, his popularity numbers plummeting. We were hearing all the criticism and, oh, he's not going to be able to win re-election and all this and that.
Right.
And then 4 years, what happened? Well, he got reelected by a large margin. Now, there was a flawed Democratic candidate. Let's not forget that. But still, he was reelected. And a lot of the people who, you know, were upset with him at the time of Senate Bill 5 have gone on to back him in the presidential primary even. So, you know, 2 years is a long time. And, you know, what happens if President Trump gets in there? There's a lot of infighting. A lot of the people who, you know, we're all discussing right now who we think could potentially hurt Kasich's run, they might actually end up staying silent or helping Kasich. We just don't know in 2 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Howard, correct me if I'm wrong on this. Kyle Condix, somebody that you and I follow quite a bit, follow quite a bit, was talking about how if Ohio went for Trump in this particular election, which it did, that it would be a sign that Ohio is starting to lean more Republican, and it's losing its bellwether status. So I'm wondering if you think this election is a sign that's what's happening.
Well, it is a sign, not so much that he won, because, you know, one of the marks of a bellwether state is that they vote for the winning candidate. But the other one is that they're close to the national average in terms of the popular vote, and Ohio was not. You know, it was way out of whack with what the popular vote was. So, yeah, Ohio, and Kyle Condix has written something in the Sabato's Crystal Ball this week about Ohio's performance in this election, and talked about it maybe Ohio is becoming the new Missouri. Missouri was once considered a bellwether state, which has moved steadily over to the Republican side. And that Ohio may be doing the same thing. Too early to tell. We need another election cycle or two to see. And I talked to Kyle this morning about this, and we were talking about it, and we both agreed that much of it has to do with how Trump performs in office. Is he a failure? Is he a success? Does he deliver on his promises? Does he not deliver on his promises?
Paula, would you say too early to say
yeah,
for sure?
I wanted to make the point about Hamilton County. We mm-hmm. were these one of these swing counties in the whole country in 08 and 12, and we've clearly are losing that status. We came out much bluer than anybody anticipated. One of the few areas of the state that Hillary Clinton actually overperformed was Hamilton County. The Democratic Party here is very excited about the prospects for the future.
Sure. You had the Hamilton County Commission turn to Democratic control.
Five out of eight contested county offices went to the Democrats. They beat a Republican named Winkler. They beat a Republican named Dieters.
Yes, and so the Democrats are very excited about what this looks like in next year with the mayoral race, the city council race, and then in years to come. They're looking at offices to pick off because now they have the momentum and they will start getting better candidates.
Right. And the Republicans understand that in Cincinnati, at least in the city, they're going to have a very difficult time fielding candidates for mayor or for city council.
Mm-hmm. And one thing we also have to take into consideration as we're talking about this is Ohio's changing demographic. It is changing. Mm-hmm. If you look at the last census, we actually lost some seats or some electoral votes because of it. We are changing to become older and whiter. And we don't have as many as much as the Hispanic population as some other states have. Our makeup is changing. And if that continues, if that trend continues, we're going to continue to lose the population. We're also going to continue to be less alike than some of the other states.
Yes,
it would make us
true.
Less of a bellwether. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's another factor that we have to put in that pot.
Hey, Joe, another interesting development. You have a congressman from Ohio, Tim Ryan, who now says he's going to challenge Nancy Pelosi for the House Minority Leader position. Can you tell us a little bit about who Tim Ryan is and why he's decided to do this? We don't know who Tim Ryan is. Is Joe still with us?
Is Joe still there?
Okay, we may have lost Joe there.
Oh, okay.
Howard.
I don't know. Well, he's a congressman from Niles, Ohio.
He's from the Mahoning Valley area, right?
Yeah, basically. Yeah, he's from the Mahoning Valley area. He represents a district up there. I think he's very ambitious, obviously, if he's, you know, talking about taking on Nancy Pelosi. But he's also been speculated about as a potential candidate for governor in 2018 because, you know, we're going to have a gubernatorial race in case it can't run again. Some Democrat is going to have to step in and, you know, take over the mantle after the disaster that they had, you know, in 2014. He was a very, very active surrogate in Ohio for Hillary Clinton during this campaign. He was everywhere, especially in northern northeast Ohio, campaigning for, talking, being, making himself available to the media, you know, for interviews and that kind of thing. I mean, I would get messages almost weekly from his people saying, "Do you want to interview Congressman Ryan about Hillary Clinton?" So, no, I think we did that last week. So, you know, he's very ambitious, and I don't think he has much chance of upsetting Nancy Pelosi, but it'll put him on the map.
And, Joe, we were talking about Tim Ryan challenging Nancy Pelosi, so I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I'm with Howard. I got a lot of those emails saying, hey, would you like Tim Ryan to talk about this and that? And it's like, well, not really.
We could have done nothing but talking to Tim Ryan.
Right. But he's young. You know, he's up and coming. You know, and I think that the Democrats nationally and in the state are looking for a farm team. You know, they just really have got to get some younger people involved. Because if you look at their leadership, it tends to be a lot of older people.
Mm-hmm. That might be a nice opening for AFTAB, PureVal, in years to come. The bench is pretty lean on the Democratic side in the state. And that's the hard part for the local Democrats who do well in Cincinnati and Hamilton County. There's not really anywhere for them to go after this. There's nowhere for them to move up to.
But I think there's going to be opportunities now, you know, in the future for some of these people like AFTAB. Mm-hmm. Also, P.G. Sittenfeld mm-hmm. did not do himself any harm at all by challenging Ted Strickland in the primary.
No, and there's a lot of people that wondered if P.G. would have actually done better than
Ted
Strickland.
Might have. You know, I don't think he would have won, but he might have done better.
But he might have done better.
People like Nan Whaley, the mayor of Dayton,
yes.
Is a potential mm-hmm. statewide candidate for the Democrats. There are a lot of them out there in different corners of the state. They just aren't well-known statewide mm-hmm. yet. And that's going to be the challenge for the Ohio Democratic Party, is to get these people out and get them known.
I think that Ohio Democrats are also trying to work on their message a little bit.
Yeah, they're better.
They've got to connect with working class voters if they want to have any success.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was one of the points Sherrod Brown made when he mm-hmm. had a press conference earlier this week, was that he's always made it an effort to connect with working class and labor, and that's what the Democratic Party yeah. missed in this
yeah.
particular campaign.
Well,
and
that's
Biden
what Hillary Clinton missed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, she didn't go out and engage those people directly and, you know, have a message for them.
Well, and I think they've also got to connect with it, and they talk a lot about, hey, we're for the middle class, we're for the middle class. But then if you look at the policies that they've tended to really hammer home, they've been for lower income people.
Yeah.
And a lot of these middle class people, especially the middle class is just barely hanging on, you know, people who make 50, 60,000 and have a family. You know, they're sitting there looking at some of these policies that they view as very liberal. And they're saying, hey, we're going to be expected to pay for that, and we can hardly put our own kids through school.
Mm-hmm. Joe, at the state level, what happened with the Ohio House and Senate?
Well, it was interesting. They actually, the Republicans actually picked up some seats. Mm-hmm. Down in Athens County, we had Democrat Debbie Phillips. She's getting out of office at the end of this year. And so that was kind of an open seat. The Republican down there picked up that seat. And then over there, you know, we were talking about Youngstown and that whole area over there, Steubenville, that area where the blue collar came out for Trump. We had Senator Gentile, who was a longtime Democrat here, and he was defeated by the Republican there. So now we have more Republicans, and it's a stronger Republican leadership in both the Ohio House mm-hmm. and Senate than yeah. we had before.
Also have an interesting situation with one of the Ohio Supreme Court seats. That is not decided yet.
Right. It was a very close race. Who was it? Paul Fisher?
No, Pat Fisher. Pat Fisher. From Cincinnati of the First District Court of Appeals against a Democrat by the name of John O'Donnell.
John O'Donnell. How close was it?
Well, it was like Fisher was ahead 0.6%. And that caused Secretary of State John Husted to tell all of the boards of elections in Ohio to hurry it up with counting the provisional ballots. There are about 260,000 potential provisional ballots that could have to be counted so that they can decide this Supreme Court race. And he wants to have it done before Thanksgiving. So a lot of election officials in Ohio are going to be working through the weekend.
Mm.
And they have been. They've been working
right.
through the weekend.
Oh, yes.
So, Joe, there's a lame duck session of the Ohio legislature coming up. Real quickly, what's likely to come up during this session?
Oh, that's going to be fun. It's going to be a stew of a lot of different things. We're going to see all kinds of legislation. This week we've had a protest here at the State House over two different abortion bills that are likely to come up. We're likely to see some other things come up as well that might be a little bit controversial. We've got a workers' comp bill that's kind of laying back there that might come to the forefront. We've got the charter schools. We've got all kinds of different things that might be coming up. And right now, we don't really know exactly where they're going to go. But, you know, the thing about the lame duck session is it's so fast and furious that reporters can't keep up with it. There's no way we can keep up with all of it. So we just try to do as much as we can, but a lot of things can get passed quickly because we're not there to watch each and everything that's happening.
Hmm. Well, Paula, Joe, and Howard, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Politics and Government Reporter Paula Christian, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Reporter Joe Ingles, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. The Affordable Care Act could go through major changes once Republicans take control of the White House and Congress, but for now, most Americans are still required to have health insurance, and open enrollment started November 1st. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll discuss how to find an insurance plan that suits your needs. And in focus on technology, self-driving cars are coming to at least one Ohio interstate. That's Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.